Getting us to cities was supposed to be the final necessary step in our assimilation, absorption, erasure, the completion of a 500-year-old genocidal campaign. But the city made us new, and we made it ours.
That's how Tommy Orange opens his debut novel, There, There, which is one of the big breakout books of 2018, a best-selling, multiple award-winning, genre-busting epic that is not set on a reservation. It's set in Oakland, where Tommy grew up.
Plenty of us are urban now, if not because we live in cities, then because we live on the internet, inside the high rise of multiple browser windows. They used to call us sidewalk Indians, called acidified, superficial, inauthentic, cultureless refugees, apples. An apple is red on the outside and white on the inside. But what we are is what our ancestors did, how they survived. We are the memories we don't remember, which live in us, which we feel, which make us sing and dance and pray the way we do. Feelings from memories that flare and bloom unexpectedly in our lives like blood through a blanket from a wound made by a bullet, fired by a man, shooting us in the back for our hair, for our heads, for a bounty, or just to get rid of us.
Tommy Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma. He sat down with Steve Paulson recently to talk about urban versus reservation blues.
So, Tommy, this is a passage from your prologue, which is kind of this 10-page tour de force of sort of the sweep of history from the old genocidal stories of absolute brutal massacres right up to the urban Indians of contemporary America. And I have to say, it's a pretty unusual thing to write at the beginning of a novel. Why did you want to include this prologue?
You know, I wrote it for, I thought my audience was just native people or native people from the city. And even though a lot of people think that just because you're native, you're sort of born with knowledge, and it's not true. And I found out about a lot about history researching for the book.
So you did a lot of research going into this book. Yeah.
So to understand what an urban Indian is, you kind of have to go back to relocation and genocidal policy. And if you're going to go back there, there's other stuff that you have to go back to, and what's the beginning of the way this country has thought about native people. And that goes all the way back to the beginning. Also, knew I wanted to include the Sand Creek Massacre because my dad grew up telling us that story, probably the story we heard repeated the most.
What is the story of the Sand Creek Massacre?
In Colorado, we had a deal with the U.S. government. We had an American flag flying above where we were camped at Sand Creek. And the idea was that we're protected and we're not going to be attacked because we have that flag. And we had a white one up too. The men went away to hunt, is how my dad told it. There was a group of militia, about 600 men. They drank all night nearby and early in the morning came with howitzers, you know, basically machine guns. It was women, children, and elders, and they just slaughtered them. Probably over 200 people, also mutilated them. Just really horrific stuff. There was this idea that we need to be terminated.
What was it like for you to grow up hearing that story a lot?
I knew from a very early age that I was made up of two things that seemed to be in conflict. Didn't help that my parents fought a lot and had religious differences. And so for me, I knew there was a really dark and intense history of Native and white people, and I was somehow supposed to make sense of being both.
Because your father is Native,
yeah.
Your mother is white.
That's right. So it's a confusing thing.
Now, in that prologue, you talk about the rise of the urban Indian, and that's sort of the story of this book. Usually, the stories that we tend to read about from Native writers, most are, to my knowledge, are set on reservations. Are these two totally different worlds?
The reservation writing has its place and it's part of the canon and everyone knows it. But I think the number for at least 10 years has been 70% of Native people in the whole country are living in cities. And to not have had any representation of what that story is was pretty mind-blowing to me. A little bit scary to not have anybody to, you know, how did they do it sort of thing. But also, I think it left me open to do what I wanted with it because I didn't see it out there anywhere. So I'm not necessarily writing against reservation experience, just there was just a big void of story, and we're already an invisible population in this country, and the urban Indian doubly so. There's no representation in movies or literature or TV.
Hmm. You tell this story of your novel through a lot of different characters. So each chapter is sort of told from the perspective of one character. Why did you want to structure it that way?
It was at first something that I loved in reading books that have a bunch of voices and figuring out how they all are connected. So it was a craft thing that I loved and I knew I wanted to do. It just so happens that also coming from a voiceless people, to have a whole bunch of voices in one setting and having them all connect works really well against voicelessness. Also, there's a monolithic version of Native people that is still pretty prominent. This is what it means to be or look like an Indian. And it's deeply damaging because people who struggle with identity, varying degrees of connection and blood, the stick they have to measure themselves by is a historical Indian in a headdress or, you know, no other people are asked to look one single way. I think it's a systematic tool for erasure.
Can you tell us about a few of your characters? I mean, just to give us a sense of the range of the different kinds of experiences you wanted to write about.
Yeah, it ranges from young people to old people and in between. The book opens up with a character who has fetal alcohol syndrome. And when his grandma tells him, one of many characters being raised by a grandparent, she says fetal alcohol syndrome, and all he hears is drome. And he's seen differently by society, and he knows he's supposed to be stupid, and he's sort of smart about that. We have a filmmaker in the next chapter, and then we have a little girl on Alcatraz who we get a later chapter when she's older, and she ends up being the grandmother of these three boys who ride their bikes all over Oakland, and one of the boys learns how to dance watching powwow videos on YouTube. A couple of guys in their 20s from kind of a tougher part of Oakland, and there's a woman fleeing an abusive boyfriend in Oklahoma, and I'm trying to make her way back to Oakland. You know, that's kind of the range.
And they all come together in this climactic scene of a powwow in Oakland.
At the end of 2010, the idea just popped in my head. That was the basic premise. It wasn't, none of the characters were there. It was have all these characters converge, or their lives converge at a powwow in Oakland at the Oakland Coliseum. And then I spent the next 6 years writing into that.
Hmm. Did you go to a lot of powwows when you were growing up?
I didn't. I remember one when I was 5, but I don't remember hardly anything but a lot of dirt and an orchard to get away from the dirt. And then when I was like 18 or 19, years after my parents had divorced, my dad came back into town and randomly took us to a powwow at a Berkeley gymnasium. An old friend was dancing. It was the first time I saw a dancer, and it was a powerful moment.
So one of the questions that keeps coming up in your novel from the perspective of a lot of different characters is, who is a, quote, real Indian? And it has to do with what people look like, who their parents were, especially if there was a white parent, how they were raised. Was that a question that you had to deal with when you were growing up?
You know, to some extent, I struggled because people just got what I was wrong. I was often assumed Mexican or Asian in high school, even to the point of getting in fights because people would call me racial slurs. Maybe there's some kind of identity crisis around the way I think the world sees me and maybe other natives see me. But I always felt pretty solid in knowing who I was. It's part of the native experience in contemporary times. It's almost, to be an authentic native, you have to have questioned your authenticity. It's almost like a part of the experience.
It's sort of this self-consciousness is built into the process.
Yeah.
So you said that your father grew up speaking Cheyenne. I mean, that was his first language. Did he pass any of that on to you?
I wish. The time period was much more assimilation. You know, he worked full time and my mom doesn't speak the language. So there's only so much time to do it. And if the parents aren't talking, he would have had to have really gone out of his way to make sure that we were speaking it from an early age.
Have you ever wanted to learn the language?
Yeah, my sister actually just got fluent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm working on an autobiographical family novel that is going to infuse Cheyenne in ways that have made me very interested in understanding it more. I don't know that I have the time or discipline to become fluent. It would be a dream come true, though. It would be amazing to talk to my dad in Cheyenne. So I don't know. I'm open to it, and we'll see.
I'm curious about how you became a writer. I've talked with writers who have said that they knew from an early age, like 10 years old or teenager, that they were going to be writers, that that was their destiny. Was that true for you?
Not at all. I wasn't a writer or a reader. Did not do particularly well in school. I knew that I was good at sports. Nobody encouraged me particularly to do anything in school. No conversations about college. I got really into roller hockey, started playing on the streets in Oakland, and then eventually indoor roller hockey and tournament level. And then I became a musician when I was 18 and went to school for sound engineering. It wasn't until after I realized there were not very many good job prospects after graduating that I got a job at a used bookstore. I was interested in philosophy books, and Borges and Kafka really caught my attention early on because they're sort of the bridge between philosophy and fiction.
So this is like you're in your 20s by this point. I mean, this is a pretty unusual story, I think, for a writer. I mean, because you're still young.
Yeah.
And I mean, to really discover the world of books, not until your 20s. I mean, even as a reader.
Yeah. And so because of it, because of how behind I knew I was and sort of convinced myself immediately that it's what I wanted to do, I knew how much work I had to do. And so I read as much as I could and I wrote as much as I could.
Did you just do this on your own or did you join like writing workshops?
No, I just did it on my own. You know, I moved to New Mexico one time for a year and just waited tables and went really hard at reading and writing at that point.
I have to say, this is just an amazing success story to hear you describe this. I mean, without that kind of background as a reader, as a kid, and then basically teaching yourself how to write, and then given all the acclaim that you've gotten for this book, I mean, it's kind of stunning.
Yeah, I became pretty obsessed. Then I found the Institute of American Indian Arts. And so about halfway into writing the novel, maybe like 9 years after I made the decision, like I want to write. And 3 years into writing this novel, I got into the MFA program. So everything that's happened is very much exceeds what I had envisioned.
Right. Yeah, now you're up for prizes and all of that. No, there is a lot of talk right now about a new generation of Native writers that's been called a Native Renaissance, and you are put into that group of younger writers. Do you see this happening? I mean, is there something new going on right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is another one of the renaissances that people have talked about. There's this one after the civil rights or during that time period. And there's one in the 90s. I think there was like 19 Native writers being published at major.
Well, there was this whole period of sort of N. Scott Mamaday, Louise Erdrich, Leslie Marmon Silko. I mean, sort of this incredibly vibrant period. And then later, Sherman Alexie, who seemed to dominate Native writing for at least a couple of decades. And now it seems like there's a new generation. And I mean, do you see what you and some of your fellow writers doing? Is it very different than those earlier writers?
I think it's different in that we're all wanting to write in a modern, contemporary way. We are all aware of not wanting to be that Indian.
That Indian being what?
The one that we're resisting, the one that is out of date and...
The reservation Indian?
Just the stereotype or... I think everyone's trying to do something that's not been done before. I think we're all products of our time and we're writing very much with the times in mind. I think that automatically makes us different.
Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain.
Tommy Orange. His debut novel is called There, There. And that was Steve Paulson talking with him.